This is Main Street Weekend on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton. Thank you for joining us for our broadcast and online Main Street across North Dakota this Sunday morning. And this morning, our show will feature two conversations from the past week. Both are about energy. Energy policy expert Tony Clark will join us to talk about the failure of the power generating and distribution system in Texas and what it tells us about the power grids that we all depend on. And Fargo solar advocate John Bagieu will talk about the potential for solar energy and the barriers to it in our part of the country. Those conversations are coming up after this news update from Dave Thompson.
After spending the last half of the week doing damage control over comments by Dickinson Representative Luke Simons, leaders of the North Dakota GOP are now calling for Simons' resignation. House Majority Leader Carrington Representative Chet Pollard says the issues with Representative Simons began when he used expletives toward another lawmaker who asked him to put a mask on while he was in the Capitol lunchroom.
Because after that, there was open records requests, and then more stuff came out. So when we hit crossover, which was Wednesday, it had started then, and Thursday and Friday, haven't had a lot of free time, if you want to know the truth.
As far as whether or not Pollard expects to see Simons resign.
Because if not, when we come in after crossover, we will see if he accepts the resignation, nothing goes further. If not, I'm sure there will be resolutions of a severe censure at the least, and expulsion is in the statement. You know, that's a very good possibility, yes.
Simons, who is a rancher and barber, has responded, saying that he respects women and the claims are false.
These allegations are not true. They're allegations. And I thought we had this addressed because these are somebody's word against mine. This didn't happen. Supposedly in here, I rubbed someone's shoulder, which I don't do that. Supposedly I said somebody's eyelashes were beautiful. No, this is from a liberal Democrat. Representative Simons shows creepy behavior.
In one case from January, Republican Representative Brandy Pyle of Castleton wrote that Simons made an intern uneasy when he started talking about the woman's hair. Pyle said some of her interactions with Simon over the past few years have also been uncomfortable and odd. Simons was first elected to the State House in 2016 and was reelected to the seat last fall. The dean of the UND Medical School says despite falling COVID-19 case counts, it's not time to relax campus restrictions, at least just yet. Dr. Joshua Wynn told members of the State Board of Higher Education he still believes all faculty and staff will have the opportunity to be vaccinated before the start of the fall semester. Wynn says one area of concern remains how well the current vaccine protects against the various new variants of the virus and whether they prevent transmission.
I continue to feel pretty confident that we will be able to get back to a new normal for the fall semester. I just don't think that we should rush things until we have some answers.
Wynn says he does believe the recent downturn in cases across the state is due to good practice of guidelines, the rollout of vaccines, and natural immunity.
Reading of the literature, looking at the data, I would say around 40% if you include everything. So I don't think we're really at true group or herd levels yet. Greater than documented frequency of infection certainly has played a role in the decline in cases overall.
Wynn says he believes after a summer of transition, the 11 college campuses across the state will be able to transition into a new normal for the fall. The North Dakota House proposing a change in the way the buckets for oil tax dollars are structured. The change is outlined in the budget bill for the Office of Management and Budget. Republican Representative Don Vigasaw of Cooperstown said the current bucket system was the result of the passage of the so-called Prairie Dog Bill in the 2019 legislature. That bill set up the buckets for aid to local governments for infrastructure projects. Vigasaw said the current system has the bucket for larger cities ahead of the bucket for the Strategic Investments and Improvements Fund. He says that bill changes the order.
So then it'll be CIF, the $400 million, and then the larger city, the smaller city, and the county and township buckets will be below the CIF.
Vigasaw told the House the main reason for the change deals with the new COVID relief package Congress is now discussing.
Preliminary information says that out of this stimulus package that's coming from the federal government, there's going to be approximately $240 million coming for political subdivisions.
The bill is House Bill 1015 and now will be considered by the Senate. Meanwhile, the House passed a bill outlining what's to be done with legacy fund earnings. The House Appropriations Committee combined ideas from other bills into one vehicle going forward. It creates a sinking and interest fund to meet debt service for bonding. It also spells out that earnings will go into the state's Strategic Investment and Improvements Fund, the Clean Sustainable Energy Fund, to the Infrastructure Revolving Loan Fund, and some other legislative purposes. And House Appropriations Committee Chairman Jeff Delzer of Underwood told the House there is another pot of money set aside.
20% we want to set aside into an income tax relief fund to start giving the people back something from that.
Delzer told the House 40% of the earnings would go back into the fund to become part of the principal. Another section of the measure makes suggestions to the next legislative session about possible spending. For Main Street Weekend, I'm Dave Thompson.
You're listening to Main Street Weekend on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton. Tony Clark served as the chair of the North Dakota Public Service Commission and as a member of the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission. Last week, he joined us on Main Street to talk about the disastrous failure of the power system in Texas, which left millions in the dark and without water. He now serves as an energy policy expert for the Washington firm of Wilkinson Barker Knauer.
So now I do primarily energy regulatory consulting. A lot of it is for utility companies, doing both sort of strategic inward-facing consulting, but also some expert witness work in different jurisdictions and in front of regulatory commissions and things like that.
What caused the failures in Texas from your perspective? I'm sure you were interested in it.
Yeah, it has been sort of a cataclysmic event, I think is one way of putting it, in the energy industry here over the last week. Having a series of blackouts like has happened in Texas is probably the biggest event in electricity in decades, dating back, and certainly one of the largest blackouts in American history. The root cause analyses and all of that from an engineering side is going to be studied for some time to come, and in the succeeding months will be looked at, although there is some preliminary information that seems to be coming out that would give a pretty good idea of what we think happened in Texas and in some ways affected a good portion of the Great Plains all the way up to co-ops in North Dakota. So the most proximate event that happened that caused the blackouts is, of course, the much colder than expected winter weather that dipped down into the southern plains. So it was one big weather system, but it affected different systems differently. The most catastrophic events were clearly inside Texas itself. As a lot of your listeners, I'm sure, know, and all Americans are learning about this week, Texas basically has its own grid, most of the state. And it's disconnected from other grids around the country. And so it's not interstate in nature. So it's really regulated within Texas. There's not a lot of federal policy overlay on the top of it. And that's the grid that was most affected, where there were mass blackouts, millions of people without power for days. The system also affected grids around Texas. One of them that it affected harder than most was what's known as the Southwest Power Pool, or SPP. SPP is basically a grid operator that manages a portion of the grid from Texas all the way, or from North Dakota all the way down to the panhandle of Texas, covers Oklahoma, Kansas, Nebraska, sort of the Great Plains region. And there are several cooperative providers, rural electric co-ops in North Dakota that are part of SPP. And SPP itself also had stress conditions. It responded better than the Texas system, although even as far north as North Dakota, the grid operator required basically rolling blackouts where for 15, 20, maybe 45 minutes at a time, something like that, there were controlled blackouts to try to maintain the stability of the grid. But it, in terms of impact, two different stories. I mean, Texas was a very severe impact and impacted millions of people. And it was, whereas the SPP system, blackouts, but much more controlled and for a much shorter duration.
So the big picture seems to be that the Texas system wasn't prepared for the profoundly cold weather that hit it, that it wasn't winterized, and pieces of the grid started going offline, and there was like a compounding effect, a snowball effect?
Yeah, that's what it sounds like. The cold weather's the heart of it, and you hear a lot of people referring to the winterization of the grid, which is basically the power plants that the grid operator thought were going to come online ended up in, it appears, freezing up in a lot of instances, and they weren't winterized. As someone who deals in the regulatory world, what I immediately start thinking about is what's the regulatory policy that led to that happening?
And, yes.
And generators not investing in the winterization and the equipment and the firm gas supplies and all of that they should have. And that is one area that's going to be debated for some period of time, especially in Texas, because Texas has a very different energy regulatory model than we have in North Dakota or really a lot of states around the country do, which is that Texas, like a few other states, California and some parts of the Northeast, about 20, 25 years ago, they, quote unquote, deregulated or restructured their energy companies. In other words, the utility companies in Texas don't own the generation that is used to provide power to Texans. Those assets were divested into independent companies, and these independent generating companies are dependent on market signals to decide whether they'll invest and whether to shut down plants and things like that. And there appears that there was a disconnect here where those markets that Texas designed did not reward generators to invest in things like better winterization or firmer power supplies or things like that. And that's, in my mind, one of the root causes of this is that deregulation regime that Texas implemented. And I'm sure that folks in Texas and policymakers there are going to be re-looking at whether that was really a good policy.
I know that then Governor George W. Bush signed the legislation to isolate Texas in 1999, and former Energy Secretary Rick Perry, a Texan, has been defending that process. Does this mean then that consumers in Texas have an option of what power company to buy their power from?
Well, so the way that it works in Texas, and this is true in a good part of the Northeast as well, New England, New York, and parts of the Mid-Atlantic, the way that it works there is you have a wires company that's still a regulated monopoly. So the wire coming into your house, you still just have one wire. But the utility that owns the wires 20 years ago was forced to sell off all of its generation to other independent entities. And then customers can go out and they can contract with whoever they want to actually produce the power. The way that that Texas market is set up is whatever generator is producing at the least cost at that very moment is the generator that gets called upon to produce energy. And the theory being that that'll drive efficiencies. The problem is that when you set up a market like that, if you're a generator that owns, for example, a gas plant, and you've got lots of other generators that own gas plants, and you're competing against them for the lowest price at that very moment, you're probably not going to invest in winterizing your plant in anticipation of a 1-in-10-year event or a 1-in-20-year event. And the reason you won't do that is it costs a lot to winterize your plants. And if you're building for the 1-in-10-year event, basically you're bankrupt before you ever have an opportunity to make money in that 1-in-10-year event because all of your competitors didn't invest in the winterization. So it becomes a collective action problem in a sense. In a regulated state like North Dakota or most of the country, utilities plan for worst case scenarios. So they tend to build the system in mind with the idea that you need to build it for those days when it is going to be the coldest or it's the hottest and the system is stressed. And so there's a little bit more cushion or a little headroom that's built in to the utilities in, say, North Dakota and much of the Midwest as compared to a state like Texas where it was all deregulated and it was just these sort of what's cheapest right now to produce power that drove all of the investment decisions by the generating companies.
And then, of course, the backside of that is that when you have something happen like what happened in Texas and energy becomes much rarer, it becomes much more expensive. And we're hearing about utility bills for Texas consumers that are in the multiple thousands of dollars now. What's their recourse?
Well, that's exactly the thing. Once you deregulate, the idea is that you're supposed to take those regulations out of the way and consumers fend for themselves in the marketplace. Different customers in Texas have different types of companies that they went through to deliver their energy. Some will probably be more impacted than others. The one that really stands out as a particularly bad outcome is one company that exposed the deal with that company was they said they would expose you as a customer to whatever the wholesale price was at that very moment. And when wholesale prices were really cheap, which they've been for the most part for the last several years, thanks to low-cost natural gas, that worked pretty well. But when prices go through the roof, which is what happened in Texas, the price cap on their market is $9,000 per megawatt hour, which is a little hard to get your head around, but to give you an idea, in other markets, that price cap might be something more like $1,000 a megawatt hour, $2,000, something like that. So this was many multiples what any market in the country elsewhere would have seen. And in the case of those customers who are signed up with a company that provides direct access to whatever the energy price is at that moment, those people will be getting extraordinarily high bills. And I'm not sure what the legal recourse will be for them.
Well, let's talk about the grid structure in our state. It has, according to some people, been under stress. And part of the reason is because we're going through a transition period in terms of the way we generate power. How should North Dakota, which shares a similar energy mix with fossil fuel and renewables as Texas, view what happened? And given as you pointed out, we have a different sort of regulatory structure in our state. Nevertheless, what can we do to make our grid more secure?
A couple things about North Dakota more specifically. North Dakota, there's actually two grid operators who operate within the state. One is SPP, who we've already talked about. And like I said, several of the REC co-ops are members of SPP. And the other one is known as the Mid-Continent Independent System Operator, or MISO. And the three investor-owned utilities in North Dakota are members of that, so XL, Otter Tail, and Montana Dakota Utilities. And so in North Dakota, the key is going to be, number one, understanding that we are part of a regional grid, and that was really brought home this week. By all accounts, the generating assets in North Dakota and in and around North Dakota and surrounding states actually performed very well from all reports. The issue with the rolling blackouts, the limited duration ones that happened in North Dakota was related again to the Southern Plains, where some of the utilities didn't winterize as high as they should, but I'm guessing will be winterizing to a higher level in the future. So that will help. So it sort of proves that events that happen, you know, many hundreds of miles away from North Dakota can have an impact on the grid, and recognizing that. So working with our regional partners and regional peers in other states and utilities in other states to shore up and make sure that the investments are made to make the grid as resilient as it can be. The other thing will be to make sure that the state and its utilities really focus in on this idea that we have in the utility industry, which is known as resource adequacy. which just basically means, does the system have the resources available to provide energy 24/7, 365, given a number of different operating conditions? And as I said, North Dakota's system on the whole has held up pretty well to this point, but we need to make sure that those investments are continued to be made here, make sure we have the right regulatory structure to support those investments, and I think we do in the upper Midwest, but then make sure that we're coordinating with the rest of the region so that others in the region also are making those right investments, which shores up the grid. But it's going to take all sorts of resources. I mean, anyone who says you can do it with, you know, just coal or just wind or just solar or just battery storage, I mean, it is probably wrong. I mean, every resource has its attributes and plays a role, and you need them all to make sure that you have that resilient grid.
Tony Clark is a senior advisor on energy policy with a Washington firm, and he's also a former commissioner with the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission and a former chair of the North Dakota Public Service Commission. Tony, as I'm sure you're aware, everything is political these days, including the grid. And when the problem hit Texas, there was some initial comments about what caused it, and wind energy was pointed out as a possible culprit, and that's since been debunked a bit. But let's talk about the transition we're making from traditional fossil fuels to renewable energy, and that's certainly big in North Dakota and in Texas. Wind energy is a big deal. What do we have to do to make the grid a 21st century, you know, transporter of power from many different kinds of sources, including maybe me at home?
Right. Yeah. So you're right, Doug. The grid is undergoing a transition, and we need to make sure that transition happens in a smart way and in a measured way, and in a way that keeps the lights on, because you just cannot have situations like we saw over this last week, especially in the dead of winter, and especially in a place like the Northern Plains where it can be a life or death thing. So as I indicated before, I think the key is to understand that each resource has its place, and understand that utilities build different types of resources for different reasons. So take, for example, renewables like wind. Wind is usually built by utilities as a price hedge. It's what we call in the business, it's an energy resource as opposed to a capacity resource. So when the wind is blowing, it's a great resource, and it keeps prices low for consumers because it's a zero fuel cost resource. And so it allows for a utility a bit of a price hedge just in case fuel cost spike, for example. It also has a great emissions profile from an environmental standpoint, and so utilities will build renewables to decrease their emissions profile for environmental regulations. Other resources have, again, getting back to this idea of capacity, they serve a better capacity value, which means they're available when called upon. Wind can't serve that, because it works when it's blowing and it doesn't work when it's not blowing. But you need capacity resources as well, so that when you're in those conditions where the renewables may not be producing, you still have reliable power. So those capacity resources tend to be things like coal plants or natural gas plants. Nuclear units are another capacity resource. So you need the right mix of both those always available capacity resources, as well as the energy resources that help provide you with other attributes on the system.
We didn't talk about one thing which was alluded to during the Texas emergency, and it just occurred to me, something that's called a black start, which means I think that the grid totally fails, and that the utility companies or those people who are feeding and operating the grid need to do a very measured restart, and it can take a very long time.
That's exactly right, Doug. The reason that you saw, take for example SPP, the reason that they had these controlled 20-minute, half-hour outages here and there was they were trying to balance the grid. And what that means is electricity is a very unique resource. It's in some ways unlike just about any resource that we have, in that it has to be produced at exactly the same time as it's consumed.
Yes.
And so the system has to always be in balance between the what's being taken off the system and what's being produced at the system. So grid operators have to keep that stability on it. And one of the reasons that grid operators will order things like rolling blackouts is kind of a last case or a last-ditch effort to try to avoid instability on the system. Because what can happen if it's allowed to get too far out of whack is you will begin having the cascading outages that are uncontrolled, that engineers have no control over, and the system can start to really just break down entirely. Once you get into that, then you get into what you refer to as these black start situations, which is the grid is down. And in those cases, then engineers do have manuals that they hope they never have to use, because you never want to get the grid into that situation. But different generators have to be brought on at different times in order to ensure that the grid can come back online. And it's a complicated issue, because you're trying to not just some units, once they go down, take a long time to get back up. Some units can ramp up faster, but they would have to be brought back online in a certain order and matched to what the demand is at specifically that time. And so that's the worst case scenario, because that can last several days, several weeks. And the engineers who run the grid hope they never get into those black start situations where the entire grid has gone down. You're having to restart it from scratch.
The grid's ability to balance the load between generation and demand is one thing. What about its vulnerability to hacking?
Well, this is something that has concerned the utility industry and regulators. It certainly was something that concerned me when I was on FERC, and just as a private citizen now, it continues to concern me. In the past, when we talked about reliability events, and I'm talking about, pre, say, year 2000, most of the attention was focused on what we call kind of the nuts and bolts of reliability. It's things like squirrels chewing through lines, right? Or in the case of the blackout in the early 2000s, it was trees fell into some high voltage power lines in Ohio, and it caused a blackout across the Northeast. It was really just like the blocking and tackling of keeping the lights on is what really concerned us from a reliability standpoint. Starting about probably 10 or 15 years ago, this issue of cybersecurity and cyber hacking became probably just as big a concern, because the systems are more and more dependent on control systems that may be, if not protected, vulnerable to hacking. And so that's just an ongoing concern. It's something that federal regulators, utilities have been working to try to address as fast as they can to make sure that those systems are as resilient against cyber attack as they can be. But where the grid is going, the computer automation that we have throughout the grid, it's just going to be something that has to be built into the design of these systems in terms of trying to make them as resilient as possible from cyber attack.
Tony Clark is a senior energy advisor with Wilkinson Barker Knauer in Washington, D.C., former commissioner with FERC, and a former chair of the North Dakota PSC. Tony, thanks for shedding some light on what has been a dark period in history for those folks in Texas, and we hope it never comes here. Appreciate your expertise and your time with us today.
Thanks for the invitation, Doug. Good to be with you.
Coming up this week on the Thomas Jefferson Hour, we speak to President Jefferson about Shays Rebellion.
Shays Rebellion occurred in western Massachusetts in 1786. It was a farmers' protest movement because of unfair mortgage and creditor laws in the state of Massachusetts. Jefferson wasn't there, but he famously said, "I like a little rebellion. Now and then, it's as important in the political world as thunderstorms are in the natural world."
Please join us on this week's Thomas Jefferson Hour.
Today at 11 Central, here on Prairie Public.
This is Main Street Weekend on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton. John Bagieu is a former NDSU professor who, years ago, installed a solar power system in his Fargo home, which largely freed him from the power grid. But Bagu says government and utility policies can be barriers to solar power installations, which is why his company, Community Electrification, hasn't done much business on the North Dakota side of the Red River.
It's a local Fargo company, and I started it a couple years ago because really we needed to have some company in Fargo and in Moorhead capable of doing projects in Moorhead too, which looks at putting solar panels on people's houses, but also looks at EV charge stations, especially the DC fast EV charge stations. And I also like to look at replacing lights with LED lights to save a boatload of money over time. And to be honest, I have done all three of those things myself at my place. So I'm selling stuff that I personally have used for up to a decade now, including solar panels and LED light bulbs. And when it comes to saving money, let me put it to you this way. I have a 2,700 square foot house. I have an EV vehicle. I spend $100 on energy, direct energy costs between the months of February and October in Fargo. That's $11 a month to power both my house and car combined. So I'm quite happy with the results, and I'd like to have those results with other people in North Dakota and in Western Minnesota too.
I can vouch for LED lights. I changed mine over a few years back, and that made a big difference to my monthly bottom line.
Oh, yeah.
My son drives an EV. John, what got you started with solar power?
It's really, I think it goes back to my environmental kind of upbringing. I always like to go camping in the mountains of Canada. I'm a Canadian. And I wanted to leave the smallest footprint possible, you know, the smallest amount of garbage possible during my life on the planet Earth. So if an alien came by, you know, 100 years later and looked at the pollution levels of the planet, I could say to that alien, well, I didn't contribute as much as everybody else. I kind of did my share to reduce my pollution content. So don't judge me like you can judge the rest of the species that way. So in a sense, I really like the planet we have. I like to keep it as close as I can to the way it was. And we are just doing a crappy job of managing it. So I want to try and fix our problems as much as I can personally.
So how long ago did you decide I'm going to put solar panels on my house?
That was really within a year or two of buying my first house in the United States. So it was quite immediate. Another contributing factor was my wife and I had our only daughter, Mira. We named after a binary star system. So, you know, it was like that really drove home what I grew up with is like, I am passing this planet on to my daughter, and I do want her to have a better life than me when it comes to breathing, health, and just a higher quality of living for a longer period of time.
Well, let's get some nuts and bolts here. When did you install the system? Was it difficult to install? And how much did it cost?
Oh, boy, you really want to get into the weeds. Well, I'm the person to take you to the weeds. So I installed my solar panel system about, I would say, 9 years ago, back in 2012. So we're coming up to the 10th anniversary. I've been monitoring production every day since then. So I can tell you what I produced 8 years ago. I can look at the calendar or look at my data sheet and tell you exactly how much energy I got that day. It cost me about $35,000. And then I got a 30% tax credit, that federal credit. That's the only tax credit I got worth mentioning in my life. That's not standard. So whoopee, you know, I felt so impressive doing that. It was like, wow, I finally got a tax credit that wasn't normal. Isn't that great? So I actually liked the tax credit because in a sense, I spent the money to get it. And I forced the federal government to use that money to put panels on my house, which I think is a great way to spend tax dollars. So I really like the idea of forcing the federal government to spend your own tax dollars in the way that you want them to. Man, we were living a different world if that was the case. And so, but it was difficult. We had to get a company. It was a local company, built it a great job, but we had to get somebody from Minnesota to install it. And boy, things have changed. So now when I sell people's panels to them, like we had a few houses in Fargo and Moorhead recently, the last couple of years, basically, I sell them systems that are half the price and almost produce on a monthly basis the same amount of energy I get, and they're like two-thirds the size. So solar panels have come a long way in the last decade in terms of the price going down and in terms of how much production you get, how efficient they become. And so I'm quite pleased to say, boy, I got kind of a lousy deal compared to what my customers are now getting, and I'm happy for them.
Prairie Public News reporter Danielle Webster talked with you recently, and in her story, you said that you bought a Cadillac system years ago when a Toyota system would have served you better. How good is the technology now?
Yeah, it really has improved in terms of overall efficiency, the panels. So my panels are roughly the same size as the panels, the 320-watt panels I'm selling or 315-watt panels I'm selling, but my panels are 245 watts. So just on the same area, the same size panels, instead of getting 245 watts about 10 years ago, those panels are now producing 315, 320 watts. So that's 60, 70, 80 watts improvement right there. The microinverters now are highly efficient. And I've because of COVID, and I said this to Danielle too, I've actually had a change of mind basically. So I've watched this last year as 500,000 people have died in this country. I've seen the political instability. I've now seen the grid instability. And it's like, I now recommend batteries to people. You know, if you want, when I first started, the big thing about solar was, oh, it's expensive to begin with. So why would you want to spend $7,000 to $10,000 adding batteries? Well, now after this last year, maybe adding that price to it isn't such a bad idea, just having that safety net, because I don't see that safety net in other places where I thought it was.
Well, when we put shingles on our roofs, we expect them to last 20 or 30 years. How long should a solar panel last?
30 years. Yeah, mine's supposed to last 25 years. The ones I saw are rated for 30 years. And so my system, in the first 10 years, most of those years, the energy actually went up. And it a lot depends on how much clouds are in the skies. But basically, normally it's 9,500 kilowatt hours a year of DC production, and my overall production is usually plus or minus 5% every year. So it's pretty consistent.
Now, solar panels are the elements that are visible outside to somebody walking by your house, but you've mentioned a couple of other things. What else do you need inside? You've mentioned maybe batteries. You're getting DC power from the panel, so you need an inverter.
But the great thing about the new systems are, if you do go with no batteries and just use the microinverters, they fit underneath the panels now. So all this noise that is in my basement that comes from the charge controllers and my 8-kilowatt inverter, which is a central inverter, pretty impressive piece of equipment, but it makes noise when it's inverting. The charge controllers whine when they're converting the energy and changing the voltage so it's right for my batteries. Now everything's on the outside. So all you do is basically run it through the solar panels. It goes to the microinverters, which converts it to AC. And then it goes, you know, all that stuff is done outside. No noise inside. Run a wire into your circuit box and you're ready to go.
John Bagu is president of Community Electrification, and he's living the example that he wants to set for people. That is, his home has solar energy. Do you install this and forget it, or does it require more attention than our present power system? You know, I just flip a switch on now.
That's a great point. You can pretty much forget it. Like if you're a data junkie like me, you track it every day or every week or every month just to see how you're doing. But there's no moving parts in solar. Most solar applications have no moving parts. So there's very little maintenance. The only problem I've had in my first 10 years, and this is what we do now with my new customers, is that we put anti-corrosion fluid in the connections, because one of my connections for three of my 30 panels went down because of corrosion and my circuit boxes were full of water after 7-8 years. So really, keeping corrosion out of the wire connections is, you know, Fargo has tough weather. We get everything, rain, snow, wind, hail, you betcha we get it. And because of that, now all my new customers, we put the anti-corrosion fluid in to begin with so that they won't have to worry about that so much.
You gave a TEDx Bismarck address years ago where you talked about your transition from academic life to becoming a proponent for solar power, and in that matter, basically creating a business to install it. Did your example spur others? You said you've been doing some installations. Is this catching on?
It slowly is, but there are many factors in our area, specifically North Dakota, which prevent this. So, for example, the local utilities in Fargo offer some of the lowest rates in the nation. And North Dakota overall, when it comes to solar and EV use, we are last in the nation. So if you like being the worst at something, we are it in North Dakota. And unfortunately, we are missing out. I just actually wrote a kind of letter supporting the recent Senate Bill 2295, going kind of net metering, where, you know, if you want our state to, solar has more, so if you want to talk about jobs, solar is very job intensive. I work with local companies like RBB Electric, MJ Dulson Roofing. I even work with the drone company with Joey. And so it's a very, it's a collaboration of four local companies because I actually don't have employees myself. I'm a one-person company, but I work with other local companies who are experts, licensed and bonded in North Dakota and Minnesota. And now we've done these projects, EV charge stations, solar projects in Fargo and across the state, EV charge stations across the state. And, you know, we just, our state just doesn't promote these new technologies, and we are losing out on jobs. We are losing out on local energy. I mean, when people come to me, and I just had an example of it on Friday, and a person, Eric in Fargo, wants to put panels on this house. And then I tell them, well, you're with this utility. This utility pays you 2.8 cents a kilowatt hour out of 11 cents if your energy touches the grid. So you lose 75% of its value. And what do people respond then? What's their reaction? Well, I'm not so sure I want to do this anymore. And I, to be honest, I have a really big problem selling panels in North Dakota and in Fargo when they get 2.4 or 2.8 cents a kilowatt hour. And then when I sell it in Moorhead, those people with the exact same system for most of their energy get 11 cents a kilowatt hour. It just is kind of a, well, it's just, you know, it puts a damper on enthusiasm. And, you know, all 90% of the people, some people still do it. They don't care about the loss of economic value because you touch the grid. And I can go into the details of it, you know, of how they're double charging fees and blah, blah, blah. But it's just, I mean, just up front, if you lose 75% of something that you've completely invested in and some entity comes along who didn't invest a cent in the project, gets 75% of the value, nobody's going to want to really do that, would you?
Yeah, that is a difficult incentive to rationalize.
I really have problems selling these kind of solar systems in Fargo because I know they're not getting a good deal. We're last place in the nation. There's a reason why we're last place in the nation. And I've asked them voluntarily, one cooperative to change. I haven't gone to Excel yet to ask them voluntarily do that. But pretty much I got told, nah, not going to happen. And I don't know if the Senate bill is going to pass this year, but if it goes by previous years, I don't think it's even going to get recommended by committee. So as long as we give the worst rates in the nation for solar energy and not promote local energy, we are just going nowhere, basically.
Well, the Cass County Electric Co-op put together a solar farm project a couple of years ago, and I don't think they got much response. Is that why? Did you just explain why?
Yeah, they I don't want to be too critical of people too much. You know, there were issues with it. And I would also say, just based on their reaction, I'm never going to add another panel again. And they were doing it to collect data to prove how bad solar was. So If your initiative isn't really supporting it to begin with, but you have longer term implications for it, then no, it's not going to succeed. How could it? They also limited people initially to only purchase two panels. I wanted 10 to power my electric vehicle. I could only get two at the time, so why bother? So, yeah, there were issues with that.
You mentioned net metering, and I want to get into that a bit because it does turn the distribution system sort of on its head. You've got a currently, we have a generator and the power lines, and it comes to our house. And what we're talking about here is that every home could conceivably be a generator and feed the network. So what is the current availability of that where we live?
Well, like I say, you can connect to the grid. but you will lose a lot of the value if your energy touches the grid, which is why I recommend batteries, especially to people in Fargo and North Dakota too, because if you store the energy yourself and it doesn't touch the grid, then you get the full 10 or 11 cents a kilowatt hour that you're paying for it. So basically, yeah, you can do these projects. They're nice enough to let you attach to their grids, but they just give you the worst rates in the nation for economic value. So if you're doing this for economics, it makes it really hard to justify. Just as an example, I had a project last year, a potential project before COVID came along, where someone was willing to donate $60,000 to put solar panels on the YWCA women's shelter in Fargo, which sounds great. You know, that's a great gift. It's a wonderful gift. And if you think about it, that $60,000 worth of solar panels over the 30-year lifetime of the system is going to generate $120,000 worth of energy. So you're actually donating double what you initially gave with the energy produced. But because of the way the local utilities price their energy, if it touches the grid, it ends up roughly, depending how much the YWCA would have used, that they would have only got the $60,000 back over 30 years time, and the utility would have got $60,000 out of that donation for basically doing nothing. So if that sounds fair to you, then you can be happy with the way things are done. But that doesn't sound fair to me, that, you know, when you do all the work, install your own system, you lose roughly half the value to the utility. And, you know, and plus you're paying a monthly charge as well for fees too. So let's be honest, it's not just they're collecting fees off the direct energy. They're collecting fees from you on a monthly basis as well. How many times do you want us to pay a fee?
Is our current grid system a barrier to community-generated power? Does it need to be strengthened?
No, actually, I've been operating with their grid for 10 years, and there's been no issue whatsoever. So there's no actual barriers. In fact, I would say local energy is the best energy, because when I produce it, it comes out at the right voltage for the grid. It comes out at the right frequency for the grid, and it doesn't go through the transmission process. So most of our energy comes from coal plants in Grand Forks or wind farms or hydro plants. It depends on where they get it. It comes from hundreds of miles away or 100 miles away, potentially. You have to take that energy, go through the process of transporting it to Fargo. It gets upscaled to voltages of over probably 100,000 volts. Then you have to bring it down to eventually the right voltage that we use, and then you can distribute it. So actually, local energy completely bypasses that expensive transmission process. So we're actually cheaper. We're more reliable because, hey, there's no transmission line breaks or transmission problems. We are already grid ready to go. We just go straight to our neighbors. My energy probably never leaves my block because somebody's using it at the time during the day. And it's just the most efficient, cheapest, best form of energy. So yeah, we're actually helping. In fact, the last with the way the grid problems in the last winter time cold period, like last week I looked at my data, the coldest days were Sunday, Monday, Tuesday roughly. I was producing roughly 40 kilowatt hours of solar energy on those days every day, and my average is 26 kilowatt hours. So I was producing 50% above average on the coldest days last week. And my house uses about 20 kilowatt hours of day energy a day. So I was producing almost enough energy for two houses during that difficult time. And the week before that, I was, again, above average production every day of the week. So we actually help the grid out during times when our production's great and we're not affected by cold. I have never seen my solar panels freeze. They operate on Mars. They operate in outer space. Solar does. They don't freeze. If you get snow on them, that's a problem. No energy system is perfect. Let's face it. But the one thing I also want to say is basically, if you mentioned my TEDx Bismarck experience, and that was an interesting talk because I wanted to give a presentation that was comparing fossil fuels to a dragon that goes around killing people. And the people in Bismarck kindly said, "Nah, don't say that in Bismarck. It's not going to go down well." And they were probably right, but I kind of wish I still would have given it. Instead, I called it a ritual human sacrifice. And I just was, and this is what I wanted to say to people who've been complaining about renewable energy not working in Texas or in cold temperatures. I want to ask them one question. How many people, millions of people a year, are you okay with dying because of fossil fuel pollution? And so over the years, I've given lectures at Concordia on COVID's changed that, but up to COVID years, I've given two or more lectures every year at Concordia. And I point out to students that according to the World Health Organization, 7 million people a year die from air pollution, 3.5 million outdoor, 3.5 million indoor. Well, there's a new study that came out 2 weeks ago, and that outdoor air pollution number caused by fossil fuels is now 8.7 million, which is 1 out of 5 deaths every year. And I looked at that study, and I think it's actually more because they didn't include like mercury emissions from coal plants and benzene and toluene from car vehicle exhaust emissions. So I asked the people who are trashing renewable energy, how many millions of people a year are you okay with dying? Is it 3.5 million, like the WHO study said? Is it 8.7 million, like the Harvard study said? Or is it more like I think, because they didn't include other factors as well? And so I really think if you think about that, we really shouldn't be trashing renewable energy. Sure, every form of energy has its problems. There's ways to compensate it. And I would say, let's try energy storage at a local level to make the grid even more reliable. So what we do is for the benefit of humanity. It gets back to why I did this at the beginning, to make the world a better place.
Elon Musk and others have been making headlines with cars, home batteries, solar panels, and even shingles. What innovations are you anticipating?
I think the biggest one is really putting it all together, like having EV with solar and wind and batteries and storage. It's really the part of my company that I like is I just don't focus on one technology. And so Elon Musk, one of the smartest things he did, and you can question his sanity sometimes, legitimately, but one of the smartest things he did was when he bought his solar company and really combined EV with solar. You don't hear much about Tesla's solar component, and yet most of their business is the solar component, not the EV component. So I think all these technologies are coming together. We should have had energy storage on the grid, 30, 40 years ago. It doesn't matter what kilowatt hour is being produced. We should have some storage, and it should all be in local areas where the energy is used. I'd like to call Texas, what happened in Texas, the Texas grid, the Monty Python grid. And I was wanting to start a kind of internet campaign to rename Texas Grid as Monty Python Grid. But I like Monty Python so much, I don't think I want to do it to those guys.
John Bagieu is the president of Community Electrification. And John, thank you for spending some time with us today.
Thank you. I really appreciate being on your program.
We are all trying to stay connected, whether it's for work.
It has been really amazing to see how much people are getting done without having to meet face-to-face. I'm sure there will be...
Or for less official business.
We figured out rules for virtual beer pong.
The easiest way to stay connected is a way that's always been there for you. Morning Edition from NPR News, every weekday.
Morning Edition, weekdays beginning at 4 a.m. Central, 3 Mountain on Prairie Public.
We hope you've enjoyed Main Street Weekend, and we invite you to join us for Main Street Weekdays at 3 Central, 2 Mountain, right here on Prairie Public. You can also listen live online and access our Main Street podcast anytime at prairiepublic.org. In the meantime, enjoy the rest of your Sunday.